Some good news and some bad news this week on Future Tense. The bad news is that according to the scientists who monitor sea levels, I mean actually monitor them rather than just speculate about them, our current coastline is definitely under threat. And the good news? Well, as a result, many more of us may one day have oceanfront views. Hello, Anthony Fennell here and welcome. Now be alert, but not alarmed, because at least one of our major cities has a plan to deal with what's probably the ultimate in rising damp. And you'll hear about that in just a moment. And a little later on, more tales of tinkering.
Some of the most impressive people I know just live in the most extraordinary world of hoarded technology, you know, that they just cannot bear to throw out. But, I mean, throughout most of human history, we've been hoarders. You know, it's one of the keys to human success is holding on to a few spare parts, having a few resources at your fingertips.
Tinkerers and their sheds. That's the second part of our program today. But for the moment, let's stay on what's left of our coastline.
For a growing number of people, living beside the beach is turning from a dream into a nightmare. Beachfront homes, once envied for their proximity to the sea, are under threat from erosion and rising sea levels. So significant is the problem, it's become the subject of a parliamentary inquiry which is looking at the impact of climate change on coastal communities.
That's a promotional video for the Australian Government's Parliamentary Standing Committee on Climate Change, which released a report recently with more dire warnings about rising sea levels and the future of our coastal communities. The report's findings were pretty well canvassed at the time, so we won't go into them in detail here, but we have put a link to their recommendations on our website. Essentially, the All-Party Parliamentary Committee has called for ongoing and increased research, and while they acknowledge the fact that many coastal councils and state governments have already been involved in conducting their own vulnerability assessments, they make a series of recommendations which highlight a need for greater control over coastal development and greater intergovernment cooperation. They've warned that development on our coastline can't continue the way it is, and even local government authorities, long accused of being pro-development, support the call. Alan Stokes is the Executive Director of the National Sea Change Task Force, an organisation which represents more than 68 councils.
There are areas around the Australian coast that are vulnerable to such an extent to the impact of climate change that there can be no guarantee that people can live there in the future in a sense of security. What we're really looking at is the prospect of losing those attributes in the coast and in coastal communities that people find so attractive at the moment.
A life on the ocean wave, a home on the rolling deep, where the scattered waters rave and the winds their revels keep. Like an eagle caged I pine on the dull unchanging shore. Oh, give me the flashing brine, the spray and the tempest roar.
So there is recognition of the problem from legislators and policymakers. But you can't start making assessments about how much of our coastline will be affected in coming decades, and in what ways, unless you have accurate information about how quickly the sea is actually rising, if it is at all. The problem is that there are very different predictions for global sea level rise, depending on who you speak to. And even the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is little help in that regard. While they argue sea levels are undoubtedly going up, they say the overall rise by the year 2100 could be as little as 9 centimetres or as much as 80 centimetres, depending on what we do now. So who actually provides the data to indicate which end of that spectrum is more realistic? Well, I have to confess that until a few days ago, I had no idea. So I went looking. And it turns out that in the Australian region, the body responsible is called the National Tidal Centre. It's headquartered in Adelaide and it has 14 high-tech gauges strategically positioned around the Australian coastline. Bill Mitchell is its manager.
We're recording essentially sea levels every second. there's an acoustic pulse that goes down, hits the water surface and goes back up, and that is recorded. The amount of time that that takes is then reflecting of the sea surface height with respect to some sort of benchmark on land. That's recorded every second, and we then transmit that data back into the Bureau of Meteorology and to the National Tidal Centre. We can look at that data. We do monitor it on a real-time basis. We then also, on a weekly and monthly basis, analyse all of that information to make sure it's of the highest quality.
Now, the National Tidal Centre also assists South Pacific countries with sea level monitoring. Is the same approach used there as in Australia?
Essentially, the same equipment is used in both situations. We have a sponsor there with AusAid coming in and actually assisting us to install 12 gauges out in the South Pacific, one in each of the major countries that are members of the forum at the time when this went through in the early 90s.
This is the South Pacific Forum?
Yeah.
Now, if you go online and look at the maps that you provide, it's immediately clear that the rate at which the sea level rises or falls is different depending on which part of the coastline you're studying. What factors account for that variation?
Okay, when you're measuring or looking for long-term sea level rise, you really don't get that until you've measured over many, many years. In the meantime, what you have to deal with is all sorts of influences on sea levels, such as those brought about by meteorological perturbations, such as storms, cyclones, El Niños and La Niñas, going right through to the very long-term changes, such as due to land around the harbour rising due to post-glacial rebound and any kind of tectonic effects. These can all influence and actually upset your estimates of sea level rise if you don't take them into account.
Now, your organisation doesn't make future sea level predictions. Other people do that. But you provide the data which helps to determine which predictions for sea level change appear to be correct. I suppose the $64 million question then is, you know, what's the concrete scientific data telling us about which of the predictions out there about sea level rise is likely to be the case?
Well, in the last 18 years, with these highly accurate instruments, we seem to be getting a signal which is going along at around about the upper rate of the projected sea level rise rates made back in the early 90s. So I would expect that in the coming years we may see some flattening off of that sea level rise, but at the moment we're still tracking at the upper end.
And in terms of the fact that you've only been doing this for 18 years, there's only 18 years' worth of data, is that enough data to be sure about this, or are we again, do we need a bit more time before we can accurately gauge whether sea levels are rising at that upper end of the scale?
We are using the most accurate equipment that we can get, so I'm quite comfortable or quite confident that we are measuring that rate of around about 3 millimetres per year. However, we do need to obtain more data. There's no doubt about that. We have only had really one strong El Niño event during that time, and of course that would contaminate our estimates of the long-term sea level rise, so it's better if we continue our monitoring, I would hope, indefinitely.
So the hard scientific data indicates we're tracking at the upper end of sea rise predictions. And that gives support to the findings of yet another report released only a few days ago by the Climate Change Minister Penny Wong. This new document estimates that up to 250,000 residential buildings in Australia will be at risk of sea inundation by the end of this century. So, is it time to start being more proactive, actually drawing up plans for the abandonment or reshaping of our coastal cities?
I'm immediately going to let the event unfold in the way that we've put it together.
We're in Brisbane at a public presentation organised by Griffith University's Design Futures program in conjunction with a firm of architects called Gall & Medic.
So what we designed was framed by three contexts. It was framed by the local and the global picture of climate change. It was framed by our development of a design process that was based upon developing futures scenarios, again, with a focus on designing back from the future.
Dr. Tony Fry was on our program earlier this year talking about a visit he made to Sweden for a conference on moving cities. Well, he and his team took the bold step recently of entering a Gold Coast City Council Master Plan Ideas competition with a largely non-compliant bid that involved looking at the way that city could be reshaped in the future to deal with significant sea level rise. And to their delight and surprise, the judging panel took their project seriously.
Well, first of all, we were flabbergasted that we actually got anywhere. But the reason we got somewhere was, well, why we were awarded a prize was basically because of the level of provocation that our submission provided. So what we've really done is to create something that can generate a conversation, a discussion over very important issues, but in a concrete way rather than an abstract way. You know, for most people out there still, climate change is an abstraction. If you see visually how a place will change by the rising of sea levels, then it starts to make sense in a different kind of way.
But with this project, yes, you give those visuals, yeah, but you still leave it open to change, don't you? You're not saying that what you've designed with this project is the way a city like the Gold Coast should move, should change.
No, we're simply providing some ideas, some suggestions that can be part of that discussion. That, you know, in terms of the provocation, provoke people to come up with alternatives, provoke people to make decisions that are small and immediate and make equally decisions that are long term and, you know, really kind of start to direct the future across generations.
And decisions that aren't about crisis management?
No, because, you know, crisis management depends upon waiting for the crisis to arrive and then dealing with it. What we're talking about doing is actually taking action before the crisis arrives. We're talking, again, in a framework of time. You know, to move a city can take decades. To begin to plan to move the city, to design all the changes, to get all the ideas and to turn them into a really viable set of alternatives, you know, might take 10 or 15 years. So we need to begin these things now. We need to be working not in terms of years, but in terms of decades. The problems might not arrive for 70, 80, 100 years, but we haven't got as much time as we think we've got. We need to start this kind of activity now.
In the last couple of weeks, we've had the federal government talking about, you know, it's looking at the idea of having a greater role in terms of the way our town planning operates, sure, in terms of the way, you know, cities are developing. Yeah. We've also seen a parliamentary committee report that talks about the danger to our coastal communities.
Yeah, yeah.
As somebody who's been very interested in this whole area for quite a long period of time, that must be quite pleasing to see that this kind of emphasis is now being given to this issue.
It is, but equally, the connections aren't being made. I mean, at the same time as those issues were being raised, it was also, you know, suggested by the Prime Minister that the population of Australia is going to increase to 35 million people. Now, the crucial issue in relation to what we're doing is where do those people go? It isn't necessarily appropriate just to continue to expand our existing cities, and it certainly isn't appropriate to stick them on the coast. So that the debate on where we develop needs to be connected to the debate on population. And those two things need to be connected to environmental impacts. And that isn't happening at the moment in the public discussion.
Dr. Tony Fry. Among those involved with the Gold Coast 2 project were design student Nora Kinnunen and architect Jim Gore.
Well, an architect is often, well, typically someone comes along with an idea and is asked to, you know, here's a brief, draw up a building. This is totally putting all that aside and starting from first principles. The first thing that a project like this does is allow us to say, well, what are those principles? What are the core principles that we should be bringing to design? And then how does the design process move forward through working from those principles and developing ideas and developing a brief, if you want to call it that? It's a much deeper process than what architects typically do. It's moving it from to a thinking process from a virtually a technical process.
And you reverse the design process in a sense in that you went to the future to see what a city like the Gold Coast would look like and then you worked back from there with your design. Is that correct?
Yeah, and you know, something that architects say they have, which is creativity, or I like to use the word imagination, developing those scenarios is a fantastic exercise in using your imagination and being able to use the sort of spatial skills that architects have and other designers have to be able to walk down a street or to see a place from the air in your head, and then, okay, what are the components of that? How does that frame up? How are we going to end up like that? You know, that's an act of sort of imagination.
And yet you still had to come up with a plan, with a visual plan to show people of,
yes,
of how the city will look, what sort of features there will be, how it will change.
Yes, we did, but there was also, there's a fair bit of writing in our presentation that we provided. That's getting directly to ideas. The visuals are, in a sense, just simply an illustration, in a sense, an expediency for what we were trying to get at a deeper level. And in a sense, the thing that we designed was really an organisation, almost a political group or a body, if you want to call it, or an institution that's going to be put in place now to start to educate, teach people, involve them in a big design process that goes on into the future.
Now, Nora Kanunen, you were also involved in this project. We're not just talking here about relocating a whole city, are we? We're talking about retrofitting a city and then building onto it. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. We don't look at one solution as being the only solution. We looked at relocating parts of the city because they were inundated. We looked at what we do with the leftovers of that city. So what do we do with the buildings and the structures that are left behind? And there's obviously a use for those. We looked at it from a cultural perspective and maybe a reminder that we need a reminder of our unsustainability. We developed the scenario that we would move some people inland to another satellite city or a dormitory city. That's, again, just one solution. So it's a very multifaceted solution that we came up with.
Nora, in putting together the plan, what sort of differences did you have to take into account in terms of the way people will live? I mean, this isn't just taking the way they live now and transporting it to another city, is it? I mean, you had to look at the changes that will go on in terms of people's domestic lives.
Well, that's right. There's a big cultural aspect of moving or relocating portions of a city. So for us, the cultural aspect of living by the beach, with the beach, on the beach, in any kind of that sort of water-based activity culture, we had to take that information and still use that. We needed to transpose that into the new.
So what was it about the Gold Coast 2 project that attracted the judges? Chris G is the city architect for the Gold Coast City Council, and he was a member of the judging panel.
The chair of our judging panel, Michael Kenninger, framed up three concepts: inform, inspire and provoke as the means or the messages to contest or check the idea back against. And this particular scheme was the provocation. It was a long-term view, looking out to 2450, and in fact, to the planning of this particular part of the coastline. The contestants were also required, as part of their submission, to address specifically issues of climate change, flood inundation and sustainability. So these were seen as broader areas of required focus for a city such as ours. And so these designs were to incorporate in their graphic outcomes these messages.
Now, what will happen with that particular project? It's part of a broader scheme, but will it feed into future planning for the council?
As I said before, it was in fact an ideas competition, and it's about the ideas that are contained within these contestant submissions. And there is a task force in place to capture these ideas and develop that into a design brief for the future proposed development.
The Gold Coast. Sun, sand, sea and non-stop excitement. This truly is Australia's favourite holiday playground.
Now let's be honest, the Gold Coast doesn't exactly have a reputation for responsible development. But perhaps that's all in the past. Councillor Peter Young is the chair of the Gold Coast City Council's Sustainable City Future Committee.
The Gold Coast has that reputation, but I think we've, in the last few years, really started to listen to the community. We've had huge exercises to engage the community and tell us what they envisage for the future. And they've said we really put a strong value on the environment and lifestyle, and they want us to address climate change. So this council has responded to that. We've been really progressive. We realise that this is a major issue for all coastal communities. We're not going to step aside and wait for other people to do the work. We're out there in front and trying to lead the pack.
In April this year, your council released a climate change strategy. Tell us briefly about that and why it's necessary.
The climate change strategy seeks to give the city council guidance in the way that it's going to pursue all of its activities and decisions into the future, so we have a proper response to climate change. We accept climate change. We're not having the argument that you see elsewhere. We accept we have a responsibility. We accept we have vulnerabilities. And so our strategy is all about leading the community, informing the community. It's about setting the right design standards and guidelines. It's about ensuring that all of our infrastructure is going to be safe from the impacts of climate change, whether it be flood inundation or more intense, severe and more regular storm activity. We're looking at all of our governance, so every decision we make now has to be checked against climate change issues. Is this properly responding? We're just trying to get away from that old head in the sand sort of attitude.
Climate change is one of those things which gets talked a lot about, but often, you know, with limited follow-up. How seriously are other local government authorities around the country taking the threat of sea level rise, do you think?
Well, it appears to me most councils are really concerned about climate change. Some are more well-resourced than others to deal with the problem. And we're fortunate. We're a big city. We have a big budget. We've got the great capacity and resources to be able to address the problem. So we're seriously doing that. But other smaller councils just don't have that capacity. So they're really left in the lurch. They're left without guidance, leadership. And so there's recently been a lot of activity in that space from the federal government. I think that's a really welcome thing. We need national standards. We need a national direction, because this is a challenge that's common to us all. Doesn't matter where you live, this impacts everyone, whether you're in the outback. It's going to impact you in terms of storm activity, rainfall patterns. If you're near the coast, the implications are obvious.
The Gold Coast City Council's Peter Young. And by the way, the Mayor of the Gold Coast, Ron Clark, was last week named as one of seven members of a new federal government advisory body called the Coasts and Climate Change Council. The council will be chaired by Professor Tim Flannery.